It's time now for our ongoing series discussing substance use disorder as a treatable disease, brought to you by the Grays Harbor Consortium.
Well, once again, with us today, we have Dr. Sean Andrews from Summit Pacific, and then we have registered nurse Beth Hindbaugh, and we are going to talk about substance abuse. And the last time we talked, we mentioned a couple of drugs that help people kick the habit, and now we're going to kind of go into some other issues, like how does the family, how does genetics and your culture and your environment in general cause you to abuse substances, whether it's alcohol or drugs. So I'm going to start off with you, Beth.
Well, no one intends to develop substance use disorder. I would say initially the choice might be there the first time for some people, though sometimes choice is not always part of the equation. But once you start regularly using substances, your brain chemistry changes.
So this may be a stupid question, but like, say, for instance, you get hooked on coffee. Does it kind of go to the same area of your brain? I mean, is it because you feel better and so on and so forth? Would that be considered kind of the same thing?
So coffee definitely speaks to the reward part of your brain, mm-hmm. but also to the chemical dependency part of your brain. The withdrawal symptoms from coffee, if you are a heavy coffee drinker and have ever tried to quit, include sedation, severe headaches. Now amplify that.
Okay.
In terms of the misery that your body goes through when you try to stop using a substance.
Effects of substance use are seen in the parts of the brain that are responsible for things like reward, reinforcement, motivation, memory. So essentially, frequent substance use changes the way you form memories and what motivates you to get things, as well as changes the way the reward structure works inside your brain. So while we may find pleasure from simple rewards, the Seahawks just won the Super Bowl, someone with substance use disorder no longer receives a reward or pleasurable experience that way. It's much more amplified now and requires different things to be added to the mix to get that same level of pleasure.
And so that's why certain drugs are what they call a gateway drug, so to speak. Where you're doing drugs and then you decide, well, if this is this much fun, and maybe I'll move on to something else?
Not so much that, although everybody starts somewhere. Some people start with what ends up being their drug of choice, and probably that is determined by partially their genetics and their brain chemistry. So some people are very susceptible to alcohol use disorder. Some people are very susceptible to opiate use disorder. And then also are the things that you're exposed to in a small child if you have a long family lineage of substance use and substance use disorder.
So if you're genetically inclined to be a substance abuser, is there a way that you can talk to somebody that has that genetic connection and guide them along and say, well, the best thing for you is just not to use substances or use them in a different way or not at all?
I think as parents, if we have substance use disorder, we can talk to our children candidly about substance use disorder. That's one of the things that I think is important for parents in recovery and extended families in recovery. And we can show them how to do life differently. But in order to get to that place, we actually have to find our own recovery, which can be a challenge. And sometimes it's not enough. Sometimes our kids are still going to experiment. But we do know that even with kids who have been exposed to substance use in their parents, even with kids who have experienced profound trauma, which you could certainly often make an argument is related to the parents' substance use disorder, those kids, we know that one positive adult influence in those kids' life can help make safe and stabilize them over their development period when they're doing their own questioning and experimenting.
Now, in the treatments that you have, I'm just going to kind of fish here a little bit. Do you also treat people that are addicted to cigarettes? And if they're smoking, they could end up getting lung cancer or worse. So, and that's obviously a drug because people have a tough time stopping smoking.
Absolutely. We do actually partner with the Department of Health and run a nicotine replacement therapy program within our medication-assisted treatment program. But that is not my expertise. That would be Amber's.
But what we do know is that if you look at all the substances, all the mind-altering substances that you're using when you get into recovery, the more of those you lay down simultaneously, the more likely you are to stay abstinent from all of them. So if a person is using heroin and cigarettes and they decide to quit using heroin and to about the same time quit using cigarettes, they're likelihood of success of staying sober from both increases profoundly by quitting both together.
Really? I thought it would be the other way around.
So do they.
Oh, okay. Well, now, what if you got somebody that drinks, smokes, uses opioids and methamphetamines and stuff like that? So you literally try and remove them from everything.
We try to do what the patient wants to do as far as their recovery goes. If a patient's choice is to decide that they would like to abstain from using all substances, then yes, that's the route we're going to take. But we are also presenting the opportunity to seek treatment from all substances as they arise. So as patients come and see me, we talk about nicotine replacement therapy for patients who smoke at almost every appointment. And sometimes they'll tell me no at every single appointment, but we're going to bring it up every single time so that when they are ready, they know that we have the resources available and are willing to help them make that step.
So using a brand name, Nicorette would be one of the ways you do that, or something similar to that?
There are lots of different forms of nicotine replacement, and then there are other medication-assisted treatments for nicotine dependence that can also be prescribed. Chantix is one. Bupropion is another. And basically, we're going to give people any tool that's safe for them to pick up and use. Like, we don't usually use nicotine replacement in pregnancy. And some people with behavioral health diagnoses don't do well with Chantix. But we will use whatever tools people are willing to use that we are convinced are reasonably safe for them. That's called shared decision making, where we say, these are all the tools we have that we can offer you. What do you want to pick up and use? Where would you like to start? Where do you want to be? When you envision the next best version of yourself, what does that look like? And then what do you see as the path there, and how can we support you and assist you in getting there?
So visualization is part of the treatment then, I take it. Because you're saying, well, we want you to think about this and this and this. So for me, that would mean, okay, what would it be like if I didn't smoke? What would it be like if I didn't drink? And you kind of imagine that you're in that situation.
So do you ever get in your car and just think that you're going to get to the destination where you want to be without thinking about what that destination actually is? If you don't plan where you want to end up, do you ever actually get there? It's the same thing.
So quitting cold turkey may or may not be the best way to go for a lot of people. In other words, they should go to an expert to guide them along.
I would say it's a very individualized process. Patients will tell you, if you ask them what they would like their recovery to look like, they've thought about it. They'll tell you what they'd like it to look like, and it's different for everyone.
Oh, okay. So, because for me, smoking cigarettes is cold turkey. I wasn't going to try the other. I thought, the hell with it. I'm going to go cold turkey on it.
And if someone tells us they want to quit anything cold turkey, we're going to support them in their recovery plan. We might say, here's the data. And if you realize that that's not working for you, please talk to us again. But we're not going to say you shouldn't quit cold turkey. We might say, do you want support medications to decrease the side effects? But we're going to support a person's own vision for their recovery.
So when you're talking to these people and you kind of get an idea of what their thoughts are about things, can you kind of assess whether, okay, this person could probably quit cold turkey because just from what you learned from them, or maybe they're deceiving themselves, or maybe it takes a few visits before you can really analyze exactly how this person really thinks. And they may say this, but they don't really believe it because they don't have the wherefore all to do it.
I'm going to accept my patient's statements for what they are at the time. Okay. I can't read their mind. So I will ask very direct and open-ended questions to try to determine what their end goal is.
Now, what happens if you have a patient that you know is kind of snowing you a little bit? In other words, I'm going to do this, but then you're picking up on I'm not getting the truth here. How do you handle that? Do you kind of like put your fist down a little bit and get a little
I'm very direct.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, in other words, you won't pull any punches.
No, I'll just ask them straight out what I perceive to be happening.
And if they're not giving you a straight answer, you let them know that you know it's not straight, I take it.
Yes.
So is the tough love type of treatment work better with some people than others?
I wouldn't say that what we do is tough love. I would say it's compassionate care for people no matter what. Okay. So we're in the business of making sure people stay alive long enough to seek recovery when they're ready for it. And sometimes that looks like us having to make direct statements about behavior. And sometimes it looks like us having to hold space for someone while they work through big emotions. So now, it's pretty different for each person.
When you're counseling people, is it usually by themselves, or do they feel sometimes they want somebody else in the room with them, maybe a family member or something, or is it usually just one-on-one?
Just to clarify, we don't counsel patients in our clinic. We use motivational interviewing and what would be called ESPRT to help patients plan their own care path.
I would say that you also engage folks in what I like to call relational medicine, where you build trust and you make sure people know that they're cared about individually. And in that context, you're able to give them information that they need to make their own next best decision.
Absolutely. If patients require counseling, we actually refer out to community partners and other members of the Grays Harbor Consortium.
Because this is really a complex issue. You know, I mean, really complex, because there's so many little elements to it. And is it always the same, or is each one its own particular sets its own particular course?
It's never the same. Every patient has their own story and their own set goals, and they're going to move at different paces. So it's never the same.
Now, do these people sometimes end up then in a group setting where they have other addicts that they are in consultation with?
So not all of our patients would end up that way, though multiple patients do seek other forms of treatment, such as counseling, psychotherapy, seeing a substance use disorder professional, attending groups, attending meetings, inpatient or outpatient treatment.
So does this, when you're going through this, is it something that you have to deal with on a daily basis? I would, you know, every day you got to think about, okay, and this is a new day. But when it comes to the treatments themselves, how often on average do they need to see somebody to stay on the straight and narrow, or is that kind of tailored to the issues that the
I like to
has?
Use the euphemism that maintaining their sobriety or their recovery is a lot like maintaining your car.
Oh, okay.
So you need to do regular maintenance, or eventually your engine's going to blow.
What would be considered a regular maintenance?
I think that would be pretty individualized. Some patients will see me monthly if they're very stable. Some patients are very stable and still want to see me weekly or biweekly because they prefer the extra accountability. Some patients have a lot of protective factors, including seeking treatment in with a counselor. Maybe they're attending multiple meetings and they have a sponsor. They don't need to see us as often. Some patients in very early recovery that aren't comfortable going to a counselor at this time or seeking a sort of outpatient care may see us every day in the very beginning so that we can check in with them and make sure that they're still kind of feeling it, so to speak.
I just thought about the movie What About Bob? And he's addicted to his psychiatrist. I mean, do people would that be relying on you too much? In other words, they can't do anything on their own without contacting somebody that can help them through this little episode of where they want to do something they're
not
supposed to do.
I am definitely not a psychiatrist, so thankfully that's not a problem. I would say that our patients do not, I wouldn't say they rely on us too much. We do have patients that will often call us to share success stories because they are connected with us. They feel like we share in their joy as well as holding space for them when they struggle. So we often do have patients that will call us and share that they recently got a job, that they finished their DOC requirements, that they bought a car for the first time, that they're... children have, you know.
So your recognition actually helps them to kind of boost them up a little bit then, in that case, I would think.
I think the relationship with us matters. Because as we mentioned, I think, in the last episode, a lot of these folks are estranged from family, estranged from coworkers, estranged in general from society, and even from medical care. They feel like outsiders in a lot of places. So once they feel like not an outsider, that's going to be one of the places they go when they have successes or when they have relapses or whatever happens, because they know that it's a safe space. And one of our goals is to help them rebuild their network over time. That's why for us, when they meet some of these requirements, when they get their driver's license back, when they get a job, when they get an apartment, when they get partial custody back of their kids, when they rebuild their relationship with their parents, for us, those are huge steps. But also for them, as they broaden their relational network, they still need us, but in a different way and with a different level of intensity.
Now, do you ever worry, or does it ever happen where, you know, somebody that's a member of the family, because this person has never been able to succeed and now they're succeeding, but they're saying, ah, you'll never make it, you always fail, blah, 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 blah. How do you help them say, look, if somebody's saying that you can't do this and you know you can, and you have other people in your family that say that go for it, you know, but you have one or two people that are naysayers, how should they handle that?
We talk a lot about rebuilding relationships and how much time it can take to rebuild trust. And we also talk a lot about people who are not ready to be positive in your sphere of influence and how it's okay to sort of put those relationships on hold a little bit and not expect them to be normal yet. And then we have a conversation about identity. Who are you? Because only you get to define your identity. Mm-hmm. So it's a great opportunity to talk about what's your new identity. You get to choose every day when you wake up who you're going to be, and you get to target who you want to be long term and how to get there.
So that's a way to kind of boost their morale up a little bit and say, hey, you know, there's going to be people that may doubt you, but believe in yourself. We believe in you. And then as others kind of jump on board and say, hey, you're doing a great job, and they're getting they've got a job now, they can drive, they got their kids back. Those should be signs that you know, they're moving forward. And so if this person doesn't want to accept that, that's their problem.
And actually, established friendships and relationships that pre-exist somebody getting sober are sometimes fertile ground for a relapse. When a person finally gets sober and they make all these relationships back, the parents may think they can have a beer with their kid again. Oh. Or whatever, and inadvertently create what is needed, the ingredients for a relapse. So we talk about all kinds of things with reestablishing relationships. Sometimes there are relationships that you have to step away from, at least for a time. Sometimes it's a physical location. Sometimes people need to physically relocate so that they don't have the visual and relational temptations to get off track with their sobriety.
Do you sometimes talk to family members and say, you know, look, they're really making some progress here, but here's a few tips in dealing with them when they're under treatment?
Due to HIPAA, we're only going to talk to people that patients bring with them and have approved for us to have discussions with. But we are always more than happy to talk to any support people that are in a visit with a patient. Absolutely.
Well, I notice we're out of time, but thank you very much for being with us. And of course, our guests have been Dr. Sean Andrews and registered nurse Beth Heinbaugh.
Join us next Monday morning at 8:40 a.m. for our continuing discussion on substance use disorder as a treatable disease, brought to you by the Grays Harbor Consortium, exclusively on 103.5 FM and 1450 a.m. KBKW. To hear archived discussions, log on to gograysharbor.com.